Let's handle this with dignity. He released my muzzle. This can work for us, Zoe. I want you to go up to her and love her more than you've ever loved anyone before. I didn't understand his strategy, but I acquiesced. After all, he had the leash. As we drew abreast of her table, Denny stopped and looked surprised. "Oh, hey," he said brightly. Annika looked up, feigning shock, clearly having seen us, but hoping there would be no interaction. "Denny, good to see you." I played my part. I greeted her enthusiastically. I nuzzled her. I pushed my nose into her leg. I sat and looked at her with great anticipation, which is something people find very appealing. But inside, I was churning. Her facial makeup, her hair, her tight sweater and heaving bosom. Yuck. "Enzo," she said. "Hey," Denny said. "Can we talk for a minute?" Annika's friend started to get up. "I'll go get more coffee," she said. "No." Denny stopped her with a wave of his hand. "Please stay." She hesitated. "It's important that you witness that there is no impropriety taken here," Denny explained. "If you leave, I'll have to leave." The girl looked to Annika, who nodded her agreement. "Annika?" Denny said. "Denny?" He pulled up a chair from the next table, which was empty. He sat down next to her. "I totally understand what's going on," he said. Which was strange, because I certainly didn't. I didn't understand it at all. She had attacked him. She then accused him of attacking her, and because of that, we only got to see Zoe on certain days of the week. Why we were speaking with her, rather than roasting her on a spit, was unfathomable to me. "I may have given you signals," he said. "That's totally my fault. But just because the light is green doesn't mean you shouldn't look both ways before stepping into the street." Annika screwed up her face in puzzlement and looked to her friend. "A metaphor," her friend said. "Ha! A metaphor," she said. "Fantastic! This one knows how to decode the English language. We'll save her for roasting tomorrow." "I should have handled the situation entirely differently," Denny said. "I haven't had the chance to say this to you because we've been kept apart, but I made all the mistakes. It's all my fault. You did nothing wrong. You're an attractive woman, and I understand my noting that attractiveness, even to myself, may have signaled to you that I was available. But, you know, I wasn't available. I was married to Eve, and you were far too young." Annika dipped her head at the mention of Eve. "Maybe I even thought of you as Eve for a minute," Denny said. "And maybe I looked at you like I used to look at Eve. But, Annika, while I understand how angry you must be, I wonder if you understand what's going on and what the fallout is. They won't let me have my daughter. Do you realize that?" Annika looked up at him and shrugged. "They want me to be registered as a sex offender, and that will mean that I will always have to register with the police wherever I live. And I will never be able to see my daughter again without supervision. Did they tell you about that?"
"They said,"
she said softly, but didn't finish. "Annika, when I saw Eve for the first time, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't walk. I felt if she were out of my sight for a moment, I might wake up from a dream and find her gone. My entire world revolved around her." He paused, and none of us said anything for a moment. A crowd of people emerged from a restaurant across the street and said their goodbyes loudly and with much laughter, kissing and hugging before they went their separate ways. "It never could have worked between you and me. There are a million reasons. My daughter, my age, your age, Eve. In a different time, in a different place, maybe. But not now. Not 3 years ago. You're a wonderful woman, and I know that you will find the right partner, and you will be very happy for the rest of your life." She looked up at him, and her eyes were so big. "I'm very sorry that it won't be me, Annika," he said. "But one day you will find someone who stops the world for you as Eve stopped the world for me. I promise you." She looked deeply into her latte. "Zoe's my daughter," he said. "I love her like your father loves you. Please, Annika, don't take her away from me." Annika didn't look up from her coffee. but I glanced at her friend. Tears hung on her lower lids. We paused a moment, and then we turned and walked away briskly, and Denny's gait seemed lighter than it had been for years. "I think she heard me," he said. I thought so too, but how could I respond? I barked twice. He looked at me and laughed. "Faster?" he asked. I barked twice again. "Faster then," he said. "Let's go." And we trotted the rest of the way home. 52. The couple who stood in the doorway were entirely foreign to me. They were old and frail. They wore threadbare clothing. They toted old fabric suitcases that bulged awkwardly. They smelled of mothballs and coffee. Denny embraced the woman and kissed her cheek. He picked up her bag with one hand and shook the man's hand with the other. They shuffled into the apartment, and Denny took their coats. "Your room is in here," he said to them, carrying their bags into the bedroom. "I'll sleep on the sofa." Neither of them said a word. He was bald, except for a crescent of stringy black hair. His skull was long and narrow. His eyes were sunken like his cheeks. His face was covered with a gray bristle that looked painful. The woman had white hair that was quite thin and left most of her scalp visible. She wore sunglasses, even in the apartment, and she often stood completely still and waited until the man was next to her before she moved. She whispered into the man's ear.
"Your mother would like to use the washroom," the man said.
"I'll show her," Denny said. He stood next to the woman and held out his arm.
"I'll show her," the man said.
The woman took the man's arm and he led her toward the hall where the bathroom was.
"The light switch is hidden behind the hand towel," Denny said.
"She doesn't need a light switch," the man said.
As they went into the bathroom, Denny turned away and rubbed his face with the palms of his hands.
"Good to see you," he said into his hands. "It's been so long."
53. Had I known I was meeting Denny's parents, I might have acted more receptive to these strangers. I had been given no advance notice, no warning, and so my surprise was completely justified. Still, I would have preferred to greet them like family. They stayed with us for 3 days, and they hardly left the apartment. For the afternoon on one of those days, Denny retrieved Zoe, who was so pretty with her hair and ribbons and a nice dress, and who had obviously been coached by Denny as she willingly sat for quite a long time on the couch and allowed Denny's mother to explore the terrain of her face with her hands. Tears ran down Denny's mother's cheeks during the entire encounter, raindrops spotting Zoe's flower print dress. Our meals were prepared by Denny and were simple in nature, broiled steaks, steamed string beans, boiled potatoes. They were eaten in silence. The fact that three people could occupy such a small apartment and speak so few words was quite strange to me. Denny's father lost some of his gruff edge while he was with us, and he even smiled at Denny a few times. Once, in the silence of the apartment, while I sat in my corner watching the Space Needle elevators, he came and stood behind me.
"What do you see, boy?"
he asked quietly, and he touched the crown of my head and his fingers scratched at my ears, just the way Denny does. How the touch of a son is so like the touch of his father. I looked back at him.
"You take good care of him," he said,
and I couldn't tell if he was talking to me or to Denny. And if he was talking to me, did he mean it as a command or as an acknowledgement? The human language, as precise as it is with its thousands of words, can still be so wonderfully vague. On the last night of their visit, Denny's father handed Denny an envelope.
"Open it," he said.
Denny did as instructed and looked at the contents.
"Where the hell did this come from?"
he asked.
"Came from us," his father replied.
"You don't have any money?"
"We have a house. We have a farm."
"You can't sell your house," Denny exclaimed.
"We didn't," his father said. "They call it a reverse mortgage. The bank will get our house when we die, but we thought you needed the money now more than you would later, so..."
Denny looked up at his father, who was quite tall and very thin, his clothes draped on him like clothes on a scarecrow.
"Dad,"
Denny started, but his eyes filled with tears, and he could only shake his head. His father reached for him and embraced him, held him close, and stroked his hair with long fingers and fingernails that had large, pale half-moons near the quick.
"We never did right by you," his father said. We never did right. This makes it right.
They left the next morning, like the last strong autumn wind that rattles the trees until the remaining leaves fall. Brief but powerful was their visit, signaling that the season had changed, and soon life would begin again. 54. A driver must have faith in his talent, his judgment, the judgment of those around him, physics. A driver must have faith in his crew, his car, his tires, his brakes, himself. The apex sets up wrong. He is forced off his usual line. He carries too much speed. His tires have lost grip. The track has gotten greasy. And he suddenly finds himself at turn exit with no more track and too much speed. As the gravel trap rushes at him, the driver must make decisions that will impact his race, his future. To tuck in would be devastating. Wrenching the front wheels against their nature will only spin the car. To lift is equally bad, taking grip away from the rear of the car. What is to be done? The driver must accept his fate. He must accept the fact that mistakes have been made, misjudgments, poor decisions. A confluence of circumstances has landed him in this position. A driver must accept it all and be willing to pay the price for it. He must go off track. To dump two wheels, even four, it's an awful feeling, both as a driver and as a competitor. The gravel that kicks up against the undercarriage, the feeling of swimming in muck. While his wheels are off the track, other drivers are passing him. They are taking his spot, continuing at speed. Only he is slowing down. At this moment, a driver feels a tremendous crisis. He must get back on the gas. He must get back on the track. Oh, the folly. Consider the drivers who have been taken out of races by snapping their steering wheels, by overcorrecting to extremes and spinning their cars in front of their competitors. A terrible position to find oneself in. A winner, a champion, will accept his fate. He will continue with his wheels in the dirt. He will do his best to maintain his line and gradually get himself back on the track when it is safe to do so. Yes, he loses a few places in the race. Yes, he is at a disadvantage. But he is still racing. He is still alive. The race is long. It is better to drive within oneself and finish the race behind the others than it is to drive too hard and crash. 55. So much information came out in the following days, thanks to Mike, who plagued Denny with questions until he answered. About his mother's blindness, which came on when Denny was a boy. He cared for her until he left home after high school. About how his father told Denny that if he didn't stay to help with the farm and his mother, he shouldn't bother keeping in touch at all. About how Denny called every Christmas for years until his mother finally answered the phone and listened without speaking. For years, until she finally asked how he was doing and if he was happy. I learned that his parents had not paid for the testing program in France, as Denny had claimed. He paid for that with a home equity loan. I learned that his parents had not contributed to the sponsorship of the touring car season, as Denny had said. He paid for that with a second mortgage, which Eve had encouraged. Always pushing the extremes, finding himself broke, and finding himself on the telephone with his blind mother, asking her for some kind of help, any kind of help, so that he could keep his daughter, and her response that she would give him everything if only she could meet her grandchild. Her hands on Zoe's hopeful face, her tears on Zoe's dress. Such a sad story, Mike said, pouring himself another shot of tequila. Actually, Denny said, examining his can of Diet Coke, I believe it has a happy ending. 56. All rise, the bailiff called out. Such old-fashioned formality in such a contemporary setting. The new Seattle courthouse, glass walls and metal beams jutting out at all angles, concrete floors and stairs with rubber treads, and all of it lit by a strange bluish light. The Honorable Judge Van Tegum, an elderly man, clad in a black robe, strode into the room. He was short and wide, and he had a wave of gray hair swept to one side of his head. His dark, bushy eyebrows hung over his small eyes like hairy caterpillars. He spoke with an Irish lilt. "Sit," he commanded,
Let us begin.
Thus the trial commenced, at least in my mind. I won't give you all the details because I don't know them. I wasn't there because I am a dog, and dogs are not allowed in court. The only impressions I have of the trial are the fantastic images and scenes I invented in my dreams. The only facts I know are the ones I gathered from Denny's retelling of events. My only idea of a courtroom, as I have said before, is what I learned from watching my favorite movies and television shows. I pieced together those days as one conjures a partially completed jigsaw puzzle. The frame is finished, the corners filled in, but handfuls of the heart and belly are missing. The first day of the trial was devoted to pre-trial motions, the second to jury selection. Denny and Mike didn't talk much about those events, so I assume everything went as expected. Both days, Tony and Mike arrived at our apartment early in the morning. Mike escorted Denny to court, while Tony stayed behind to look after me. Tony and I didn't do much with our time together. We sat and read the paper, or went for short walks, or ventured to Bauhaus so he could check his email on their free Wi-Fi network. I liked Tony, despite the fact that he had washed my dog years earlier. Or maybe because he had. That dog, poor thing, finally went the way of all flesh and fell to threads and was tossed into the trash bin without ceremony, without eulogy. My dog was all I could think to say. My dog. And I watched Denny drop it into the bin and close the drawer. And that was that. On the third morning, there was a definite change in the air when Tony and Mike arrived. There was much more tension, fewer banal pleasantries, no one-liners. It was the day the case was to begin in earnest, and we were all filled with trepidation. Denny's future was at stake, and it was no laughing matter. Apparently, I later learned, Mr. Lawrence delivered an impassioned opening statement. He agreed with the prosecution's assertion that sexual molestation is about power, but he pointed out that baseless allegation is an equally destructive weapon and is just as much about power. And he pledged to prove Denny innocent of the charges against him. The prosecution led off their case with a parade of witnesses, all of whom had stayed with us that week in Winthrop, each of them testifying to Denny's inappropriate flirtatious manner and his predator-like stalking of Annika. Yes, they agreed, she was playing the game with him, but she was a child. As was Lolita, Spencer Tracy might have shouted. Denny was an intelligent, strong, good-looking man, the witnesses said, and should have known better. One by one, they depicted a world in which Denny maneuvered sneakily in order to be with Annika, to brush against her, to hold her hand illicitly. Each convincing witness was followed by another even more convincing, and another after that, until, finally, the alleged victim herself was called to take the stand. Wearing a subdued skirt and high-collared blouse, her hair pinned back and eyes downcast, Annika proceeded to catalog every look, glance, and breath, every incidental touch and near miss. She admitted that she was a willing, even eager accomplice, but insisted that, as a child, she had no idea what she was getting herself into. Visibly upset, she spoke about how the entire episode had tormented her ever since. Tormented her in what way, I would have asked. By her innocence, or by her guilt? But I wasn't there to pose the question. By the time Annika's direct examination was finished, not a person in the courtroom, save Denny himself, was absolutely certain that he had not taken liberties with her that week. And even Denny's confidence in himself was shaken. Early that afternoon, it was Wednesday, the weather was oppressive. The clouds were heavy, but the sky refused to rain. Tony and I walked down to Bauhaus so he could get his coffee. We sat outside and stared at the traffic on Pine Street until my mind shut down and I lost track of time. Enzo? I raised my head. Tony pocketed his cell phone. That was Mike. The prosecutor asked for a special recess. Something's going on. He paused, waiting for my response. I said nothing. What should we do? He asked. I barked twice. We should go. Tony closed up his computer and got his bag together. We hurried down Pine and across the freeway overpass. He was moving very quickly, and I had a hard time keeping up. When he felt the leash go taut, he looked back at me and slowed. We have to hurry if we want to catch them, he said. I wanted to catch them too, but my hips ached so. We hustled past the Paramount Theater to Fifth Avenue. We rushed south, zigzagging from walk to don't walk signals
until we reached the plaza before the courthouse on 3rd Avenue. Mike and Denny were not there, only a small cluster of people in one corner of the plaza, speaking urgently, gesturing with agitation. We started toward them. Perhaps they knew what was going on. But at that moment, the rain began to fall. The group immediately disbanded, and I saw Annika among them. Her face was drawn and pale. She was crying. When she saw me, she winced, turned away quickly, and vanished into the building. Why was she so upset? I didn't know, but it made me very nervous. What could be going on inside that building, in the dark chambers of justice? What might she have said to further incriminate Denny and destroy his life? How I prayed for some kind of intervention, for the spirit of Gregory Peck or Jimmy Stewart or Raoul Julia to descend on the plaza and lead us to the truth, for Paul Newman or Denzel Washington to step out of a passing bus and deliver a rousing speech that would set everything right. Tony and I took refuge underneath an awning. We stood tensely. Something was going on, and I didn't know what it was. I wished that I could have injected myself into the process, snuck into the courtroom, leapt on a table and made my voice heard. But my participation was not part of the plan.
"It's done now," Tony said. "We can't change what's already been decided."
"Can't we?" I wondered. "Even just a little? Can we not will ourselves to achieve the impossible? Can we not use the power of our life force to change something? One small thing? One insignificant moment? One breath? One gesture? Is there nothing we can do to change what is around us?" My legs were so heavy I could no longer stand. I lay on the wet concrete, and I fell into an unsteady sleep filled with very strange dreams.
"Ladies and gentlemen of the jury," Mr. Lawrence said, standing before the jury box, "it is important to note that the case put forth by the prosecution is entirely circumstantial. There is no evidence whatsoever of violation. The truth of what really happened that night is known by two people alone. Two people. And a dog."
"A dog?" the judge asked incredulously.
"Yes, Judge Von Tiegum," Mr. Lawrence said, stepping forth boldly. "The entire event was witnessed by the defendant's dog. I call to the stand, Enzo."
"I object," the prosecutor barked. "Sustained," the judge said, "for the time being." He produced a large volume from beneath his desk and paged through it at length, reading many passages. "Does this dog speak?" the judge asked Mr. Lawrence, his head still buried in the book.
"With the help of a voice synthesizer," Mr. Lawrence said, "yes, the dog speaks."
"I object," the prosecutor piped in. "Not yet," the judge said. "Tell me about this device, Mr. Lawrence."
"We've borrowed a special voice synthesizer that was developed for Stephen Hawking," Mr. Lawrence continued, "by reading the electrical pulses of the inner brain."
"Enough! You had me at Stephen Hawking."
"With this device, the dog can speak," Mr. Lawrence said. The judge clapped shut his massive tome.
"Objection overruled. Let's have him then, this dog. Let's have him."
The room was filled with hundreds of people, and I was sitting on the witness stand, strapped to Stephen Hawking's voice simulator. The judge swore me in.
"Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?"
"I do," I said, in my scratchy metallic voice, which was not at all as I had imagined. I had always hoped I would sound more commanding and present, like James Earl Jones.
"Mr. Lawrence," the judge said, astonished, "your witness?"
"Enzo," Mr. Lawrence said, "you were present for the alleged molestation?"
"I was," I said.
Suddenly, there was silence in the gallery. Suddenly, no one dared to speak, to titter, or even to breathe. I was talking, and they were listening.
"Tell us in your own words what you witnessed in Mr. Swift's bedroom that night."
"I will tell you," I said. "But first, with permission, I would like to address the court." "You may," the judge said. "Inside each of us resides the truth," I began. "The absolute truth. But sometimes the truth is hidden in a hall of mirrors. Sometimes we believe we are viewing the real thing,
when in fact we are viewing a facsimile, a distortion. As I listen to this trial, I am reminded of the climactic scene of a James Bond film, The Man with the Golden Gun. James Bond escaped his Hall of Mirrors by breaking the glass, shattering the illusions, until only the true villain stood before him. We, too, must shatter the mirrors. We must look into ourselves and root out the distortions until that thing which we know in our hearts is perfect and true stands before us. Only then will justice be served. I looked over the faces in the room and saw each of them considering my words, nodding appreciatively. Nothing happened between them, I said, finally. Nothing at all.
But we've heard so much of these accusations, Mr. Lawrence said.
Your Honor, I raised my voice. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I assure you that my master, Dennis Swift, in no way acted inappropriately around this young lady, Annika. It was clear to me that she loved him more than anything in the world, and she offered herself to him. He declined her offer. After driving us over a harrowing mountain pass, after exhausting himself, draining himself of all physical energy in order to deliver us safely home, Denny is guilty only of falling asleep. Annika, this girl, this woman, as unaware of the ramifications of her actions as she might have been, assaulted my Denny.
A murmur rose from the gallery.
Miss Annika, is this true?
The judge demanded.
It is true,
Annika replied.
Do you disavow these accusations?
Van Tegem asked.
I do, she cried. I'm so sorry for the pain I've put you all through. I disavow.
This is a stunning revelation, Van Tegem announced. Enzo the dog has spoken. The truth is known. This case is dismissed. Mr. Swift is free to go, and he is awarded custody of his daughter.
I leapt from the witness stand and embraced Denny and Zoe. At last, we were a family, together again.
It's over, my master's voice. I opened my eyes.
Denny was flanked by Mike and Mr. Lawrence, who held a very large umbrella. How much time had passed, I didn't know. But Tony and I were both very wet from the rain.
That recess was the longest 45 minutes of my life, Denny said.
I waited for his answer.
She recanted, he said. They dropped the charges.
He fought it, I know, but it was hard for him to breathe.
They dropped the charges, and I'm free.
Denny might have been able to hold it off if we had been alone, but Mike wrapped him in a hug, and Denny unleashed the years of tears that had been dammed behind mud and determination, and the ability to always find another finger to stick in the leaking dike. He cried so hard.
Thank you, Mr. Lawrence, Tony said, shaking Mr. Lawrence's hand. You did a fantastic job.
Mr. Lawrence smiled, perhaps for the first time in his life.
They had no physical evidence, he said. All they had was Annika's testimony. I could tell on direct she was wavering. There was something more she wanted to say. So I went after her on cross, and she broke down. She said that up until now, she'd been telling people what she had hoped might have happened. Today, she admitted that nothing happened at all. Without her testimony, it would have been foolish for the prosecutor to move forward with the case.
Is that what she testified? I wondered where she was, what she was thinking. I glanced around the plaza and spotted her leaving the courthouse with her family. She seemed somehow fragile. She looked over and saw us. She was not a bad person, I knew then. One can never be angry at another driver for a track incident. One can only be upset at himself for being caught in the wrong place at the wrong time. She gave a quick wave meant for Denny, but I was the only one who saw because I was the only one looking. So I barked to let her know.
You've got a good master there,
Tony said to me, his attention still on our immediate circle. He was right. I have the best master. I watched as Denny held on to Mike and swayed back and forth, feeling the relief, the release, knowing that another path might have been easier for him to travel, but that it couldn't possibly have offered a more satisfying conclusion. 57. The very next day, Mr. Lawrence informed Denny that the evil twins had dropped their custody suit. Zoe was his. The twins had requested 48 hours to assemble her belongings and spend a little more time with her before delivering her to Denny, but he was under no obligation to agree. Denny could have been mean. He could have been spiteful. They took years of his life. They took all of his money. They robbed him of work. They tried to destroy him. But Denny is a gentleman. Denny has compassion for his fellow man. He granted them their request. He was baking cookies last night in anticipation of Zoe's return, making the batter from scratch like he used to, when the phone rang. Since his hands were covered with sticky oatmeal goop, he tapped the speaker button on the kitchen phone. "You're on the air," he said brightly. "Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?" There was a long pause filled with static.
"I'm calling for Dennis Swift."
"This is Denny," Denny called from his cookie bowl. "How can I help you?"
"This is Luca Pantoni, returning your call from Maranello. Am I catching you at a bad time?"
Denny's eyebrows shot up. He smiled at me.
"Luca, grazie for returning my call. I'm making cookies, so I have you on the speakerphone. I hope you don't mind." "No problem."
"Luca, the reason I called, the issues that were keeping me in the States have been resolved."
"I can tell by the tone of your voice they were resolved to your satisfaction," Luca observed.
"Very much so," Denny said.
"Yes, indeed. I was wondering if the position you offered me earlier was still available." "Of course.
My daughter and I, and my dog, Enzo, would very much like to join you for dinner in Maranello then."
"Your dog is named Enzo. How propitious."
"He is a race car driver at heart," Denny said, and he smiled at me. "I love Denny so much. I know everything about him, and yet he always surprises me. He called Luca."
"I look forward to meeting your daughter and to seeing Enzo again," Luca said. "I will have my assistant make the arrangements. It will be necessary to retain your services under contract. I hope you understand the nature of our business, as well as the expense of developing a test driver."
"I understand," Denny replied, plopping oatmeal and raisins onto the cookie sheet.
"You do not object to a 3-year commitment?" Luca asked. "Your daughter will not mind living here. There is an American school if she would prefer it to our Italian schools."
"She told me she wants to try the Italian school," Denny said. "We'll have to see how it goes. Either way, she knows it'll be a great adventure, and she's very excited. She's been studying a children's book I gave her that teaches some simple Italian phrases. She says she feels confident ordering pizza in Maranello, and she loves pizza."
"Bene. I love pizza, too. I like the way your daughter thinks, Denny. I'm so pleased I can be a part of your fresh start."
Denny plopped more cookies, almost as if he had forgotten about the telephone call.
"My assistant will be in touch with you, Denny. We will expect to see you in a few weeks."
"Yes, Luca, thank you." Plop, plop. "Luca?"
"Si."
"Now will you tell me why?" Denny asked. Another long pause.
"I would prefer to tell you."
"Yes, I know, Luca, I know. But it would help me so much if you could see your way to telling me now, for my own peace of mind."
"I understand your need," Luca said. "I will tell you. Many years ago, when my wife passed away, I almost died from grief."
"I'm sorry," Denny said, no longer working the cookie batter, simply listening.
"Thank you," Luca said. "It took me a long time to know how to respond to people offering their condolences. Such a simple thing, yet filled with much pain. I'm sure you understand."
"I do," Denny said.
"I would have died of grief, Denny, if I had not received help, if I had not found a mentor who offered me his hand. Do you understand? My predecessor at this company offered me a job driving cars for him. He saved my life, not merely for me, but for my children as well. This man passed away recently. He was very old. But still, sometimes I see his face, I hear his voice, and I remember him. What he offered me is not for me to keep, but for me to give to another. That is why I feel very fortunate that I am able to offer my hand to you.
Then he stared at the phone as if he could see Luca in it.
Thank you, Luca, for your hand, and for telling me why you have offered it.
My friend, Luca said, the pleasure is entirely mine. Welcome to Ferrari. I assure you, you will not want to leave.
They said their goodbyes, and Denny pressed the button with his pinky. He crouched down and held out his sticky hands for me, and I obligingly licked them clean.
Sometimes I believe, he said to me as I indulged in the sweetness of his hands, of his fingers, of his opposable thumbs. Sometimes I really do believe.
58. The dawn breaks gently on the horizon and spills its light over the land. My life seems like it has been so long and so short at the same time. People speak of a will to live. They rarely speak of a will to die, because people are afraid of death. Death is dark and unknown and frightening, but not for me. It is not the end. I can hear Denny in the kitchen. I can smell what he's doing. He's cooking breakfast, something he used to do all the time when we were a family, when Eve was with us and Zoe. For a long time they have been gone, and Denny has eaten cereal. With every bit of strength I have in my body, I wrench myself to a standing position. Oh, my hips are frozen, and my legs burn with pain. I hobble to the door of the bedroom. Growing old is a pathetic thing. It is full of limitations and reduction. It happens to us all, I know. But I think that it might not have to. I think it happens to those of us who request it. And in our current mindset, our collective ennui, it is what we have chosen to do. But one day, a mutant child will be born who refuses to age, who refuses to acknowledge the limitations of these bodies of ours, who lives in health until he is done with life, not until his body no longer supports him. He will live for hundreds of years, like Noah, like Moses. This child's genes will be passed to his offspring, and more like him will follow. And their genetic makeup will supplant the genes of those of us who need to grow old and decay before we die. I believe that one day it will come to pass. However, such a world is beyond my purview.
Yo, Zoe, he calls to me when he sees me. How are you feeling?
Like shit, I reply. But of course, he doesn't hear me.
I made you pancakes,
he says cheerfully. I force myself to wag my tail, and I really shouldn't have, because the wagging jostles my bladder, and I feel warm droplets of urine splash my feet.
It's okay, boy, he says. I've got it.
He cleans up my mess and tears me a piece of pancake. I take it in my mouth, but I can't chew it. I can't taste it. It sits on my tongue limply until it finally falls out of my mouth and onto the floor. I think Denny notices, but he doesn't say anything. He keeps flipping the pancakes, setting them on the rack to cool. I don't want Denny to worry about me. I don't want to force him to take me on a one-way visit to the vet. He loves me so much. The worst thing I could possibly do to Denny is make him hurt me. The concept of euthanasia has some merit, yes, but it is too fraught with emotion. I much prefer the idea of assisted suicide, which was developed by the inspired physician Dr. Kevorkian. It's a machine that allows an ailing elder to push a button and take responsibility for his own death. There is nothing passive about the suicide machine. A big red button. Press it or don't. It is a button of absolution. My will to die. Perhaps, when I am a man, I will invent a suicide machine for dogs. When I return to this world, I will be a man. I will walk among you. I will lick my lips with my small, dexterous tongue. I will shake hands with other men, grasping firmly with my opposable thumbs. And I will teach people all that I know. And when I see a man or a woman or a child in trouble, I will extend my hand, both metaphorically and physically. I will offer my hand to him, to her, to you, to the world. I will be a good citizen,
a good partner in the endeavor of life that we all share. I go to Denny, and I push my muzzle into his thigh. "There's my Enzo," he says. And he reaches down out of instinct. We've been together so long. He touches the crown of my head, and his fingers scratch at the crease of my ears. The touch of a man. My legs buckle, and I fall.
"Zo?"
He is alarmed. He crouches over me. "Are you okay?" "I am fine. I am wonderful. I am. I am.
Zo?"
He turns off the fire under the frying pan. He places his hand over my heart. The beating that he feels, if he feels anything at all, is not strong. In the past few days, everything has changed. He is going to be reunited with Zoe. I would like to see that moment. They are going to Italy together, to Maranello. They will live in an apartment in the small town, and they will drive a Fiat. Denny will be a wonderful driver for Ferrari. I can see him, already an expert on the track because he is so quick, so smart. They will see his talent, and they will pluck him from the ranks of test drivers and give him a tryout for the Formula One team. Scuderia Ferrari. They will choose him to replace the irreplaceable Schumi. "Try me," he will say. And they will try him. They will see his talent and make him a driver. And soon, he will be a Formula One champion, just like Ayrton Senna. Like Juan Manuel Fangio. Jim Clark. Like Jackie Stewart. Nelson Piquet. Alain Prost. Niki Lauda. Nigel Mansell, like Michael Schumacher. My Denny. I would like to see that. All of it, beginning this afternoon when Zoe arrives and is once again together with her father. But I don't believe I will get the chance to see that moment. And anyway, it is not for me to decide. My soul has learned what it came to learn. And all the other things are just things. We can't have everything we want. Sometimes, we simply have to believe.
"You're okay," he says.
He cradles my head in his lap. I see him. I know this much about racing in the rain. I know it is about balance. It is about anticipation and patience. I know all of the driving skills that are necessary for one to be successful in the rain, but racing in the rain is also about the mind. It is about owning one's own body, about believing that one's car is merely an extension of one's body, about believing that the track is an extension of the car, and the rain is an extension of the track, and the sky is an extension of the rain. It is about believing that you are not you. You are everything, and everything is you. Racers are often called selfish and egotistical. I myself have called race car drivers selfish. I was wrong. To be a champion, you must have no ego at all. You must not exist as a separate entity. You must give yourself over to the race. You are nothing if not for your team, your car, your shoes, your tires. Do not mistake confidence and self-awareness for egotism. I saw a documentary once. It was about dogs in Mongolia. It said that the next incarnation for a dog who is ready to leave his dogness behind, is as a man. I am ready. And yet, Denny is so very sad. He will miss me so much. I would rather stay with him and Zoe here in the apartment and watch the people on the street below as they talk to each other and shake each other's hands.
"You've always been with me," Denny says to me. "You've always been my Enzo."
"Yes, I have." He's correct.
"It's okay," he says to me. "If you need to go now, you can go."
I turn my head, and there, before me, is my life, my childhood, my world. My world is all around me, all around the fields of Spangle, where I was born, the rolling hills, covered with the golden grasses that sway in the wind and tickle my stomach when I move over them. The sky, so perfectly blue, and the sun, so round. This is what I would like. To play in those fields for a little longer. To spend a little more time being me before I become someone else. This is what I would like. And I wonder, have I squandered my dogness? Have I forsaken my nature for my desires? Have I made a mistake by anticipating my future and shunning my present? Perhaps I have. An embarrassing deathbed regret. Silly stuff. The first time I saw you, he says, I knew we belonged together.
Yes, me too. It's okay.
I saw a film once, a documentary, on the television, which I watch a lot. Denny once told me not to watch so much. I saw a documentary about dogs in Mongolia. It said that after dogs die, they return as men. But there was something else. I feel his warm breath on my neck, his hands. He leans down to me, though I can no longer see him. He leans down to my ear. The fields are so large, I could run forever in one direction and then run forever back. There is no end to these fields.
It's okay, boy,
he says softly, gently into my ear.
I remember.
This documentary said that after a dog dies, his soul is released into the world around us. His soul is released to run in the world, run through the fields, enjoy the earth, the wind, the rivers, the rain, the sun, the... When a dog dies, his soul is released to run until he is ready to be reborn. I remember.
It's okay.
When I am reborn as a man, I will find Denny. I will find Zoe. I will walk up to them and shake their hands and tell them that Enzo says hello. They will see.
You can go.
Before me I see my world. The fields around Spangle. There are no fences, no buildings, no people. There is only me and the grass and the sky and the earth. Only me. I love you, boy. I take a few steps into the field and it feels so good, so nice to be in the cool air, to smell the smells all around me, to feel the sun on my coat. I feel like I am here.
You can go.
I gather my strength and I start off and it feels good. Like I have no age at all, like I am timeless. I pick up speed. I run. It's okay, Enzo. I don't look back, but I know he's there. I bark twice because I want him to hear. I want him to know. I feel his eyes on me, but I don't turn back. Off into the field, into the vastness of the universe ahead, I run. You can go, he calls to me. Faster, the wind presses against my face as I run faster. I feel my heart beating wildly, and I bark twice to tell him. To tell everyone in the world to say faster. I bark twice so he knows. So he remembers. What I want now is what I've always wanted. One more lap, Denny.
One more lap. Faster.
Imola, Italy. After it is all over, after the last race has been won, after the season's champion has been crowned, he sits alone in the infield of the Tamburello corner, on the grass that is soggy from many days of rain, a bright figure in his Ferrari red Nomex racing suit, which is covered with patches of the many sponsors who want him as their figurehead, their image, as the one whom they can hold before the world as their symbol. The champion sits alone. All around Japan, Brazil, around Italy, Europe, the world, people celebrate his victory. In the trailers and the back rooms, the other drivers, some of whom are half his age, shake their heads in amazement. To have accomplished what he has accomplished, to have endured what he has endured, to have become a Formula One champion out of nowhere, at his age,
It is nothing less than a fairy tale. An electric golf cart stops on the tarmac near him, driven by a young woman with long golden hair. With her in the cart are two other figures, one large and one small. The young woman climbs out and walks toward the champion. "Dad?" she calls. He looks to her, though he had hoped to be alone just a little longer. "They're big fans," she says. He smiles and rolls his eyes. The idea that he has fans at all, big or small, is very silly to him and something he has to get used to. "No, no," she says, because she knows his thoughts almost before he can think them. "I think you'd really like to meet them." He nods at her because she is always right. She beckons the two people in the cart. A man steps out, hunched beneath a rain poncho, then a child. They walk toward the champion.
"Danny!"
the man calls. He does not recognize them. He does not know them.
"Danny, speravamo di trovarlo qui."
"Eccomi,"
the champion replies.
"Danny, we are your biggest fans. Your daughter brought us to find you. She said you would not mind."
"She knows me," the champion says warmly.
"My son," says the man. "He worships you. He talks about you always."
The champion looks at the boy, who is small, with sharp features and icy blue eyes and light curly hair.
"Quanti, ani hai?"
he asks.
"Cinque,"
the boy replies.
"Do you race?"
"He races the carts,"
the father says.
"He's very good. The first time he sat in a cart, he knew how to drive it. It's very expensive for me, but he's so good, such a talent, that we do it."
"Bene, che bello," the champion says.
"Will you sign our program?"
the father asks.
"We watch the race from the field over there. The grandstand is very expensive. We drove from Napoli."
"Certo,"
the champion says to the father. He takes the program and pen.
"Come ti chiami?"
he asks the boy.
"Enzo,"
the boy says. The champion looks up, startled. For a moment, he doesn't move. He doesn't write. He doesn't speak.
"Enzo?"
he asks, finally.
"Sì,"
the boy says.
"Mi chiamo Enzo. Anch'io voglio diventare un campione."
Stunned, the champion stares at the boy.
"He says he wants to be a champion,"
the father translates, misinterpreting the pause.
"Like you."
"Ottima idea,"
the champion says. But he continues staring at the boy until he realizes he's been staring too long and shakes his head to stop himself.
"Mi scusi," he says. "Your son reminds me of a good friend of mine."
He catches his daughter's eye. Then he signs the boy's program and hands it to the father, who reads it.
"Che cos'è?"
the father asks.
"My telephone number in Maranello,"
the champion says. "When you think your son is ready, call me. I'll make sure he gets proper instruction and the opportunity to drive."
"Grazie. Grazie mille,"
the man says.
"He talks about you always. He says you are the best champion ever. He says you are better, even than Senna."
The champion rises, his racing suit still wet from the rain. He pats the boy's head and ruffles his hair. The boy looks up at him. "He is a race car driver at heart," the champion says.
"Grazie,"
the father says.
"He studies all of your races on videotape." "La macchina va dove vanno gli occhi,"
the boy says. The champion laughs, then looks to the sky.
"Sì,"
he says. "The car goes where the eyes go." "It is true, my young friend. It is very, very true." This recording was produced and directed by Karen DiMattia. It was recorded at Harper Audio Studios by Dan Mackesy.
It was edited by Valerie Raytron. Mixing and mastering were by Lance Neal.
Hello, this is Cherry Jones, Tony Award-winning actress and narrator of the Little House on the Prairie audiobooks. As an audiobook listener, you know the pleasure of being captivated by a well-told story. You may not know that children who listen to audiobooks enjoy academic benefits as well. Hearing stories read aloud helps children reinforce important fundamental elements of reading readiness and reading comprehension, two key elements of overall success in school. When children listen to recorded stories, they hear and learn new vocabulary, and they practice active listening skills. Children can also listen up. Advanced readers can find challenging and complex stories. Delayed readers can listen and enjoy the story as a whole before breaking it down into smaller pieces. For all children, hearing a good book encourages a lifelong love of literature and reading. So, when you consider what to listen to next, why not also think about the pint-sized listeners in your life and select from one of the many available children's audiobooks?
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.